Quickly, Andrea, conflict amendments, House Bill 2112.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2112, you'll realize, you'll recall that we heard last week, that is the UEDA bill. It adopts the Uniform Electronic Transaction Act. You should have in your package the A6 amendments. Those are conflict amendments.
Thank you. Senator Courtney?
Mr. Chair, I move the A6 amendments to a House bill.
Suspend the rules to reconsider.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I move that we suspend the rules by which we voted upon House Bill 2112.
Senator Courtney moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering House Bill 2112.
2112.
Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that we reconsider the vote on House Bill 2112.
Senator Courtney moves that we reconsider the vote by which we passed on House Bill 2112. A. Gross before the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash A6 amendments to House Bill 2112.
Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the A6 amendments to House Bill 2112. Any discussion? Conflict amendments? Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2112 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2112 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Who is the carrier on that?
Senator Nelson.
And he will continue to carry the bill, notwithstanding his absence today. All right, conflict amendments, House Bill 2800.
Mr. Chair, I move
these are your extras.
That's better.
Where is it? 2800. You got amendments?
Where are the conflict amendments?
Well, let me just get the doggone.
Senator Courtney,
Mr. Chair, I move we suspend the rules and reconsider the vote on House Bill 2800.
All right. Senator Courtney moves that we suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering the vote by which we cast on House Bill 2800. Is there any discussion? Objections to suspending rules? Here.
Mr. Chair, I move we reconsider the vote on House Bill 2800. Doggone it.
Senator Courtney moves that we reconsider the vote by which we passed out House Bill 2800 before the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? None. It's back in front of us. We have conflict amendments in front of us. Here.
I don't have them. What's the dash on it, please, Councilman?
Dash 12.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 12 amendments to House Bill 2800.
Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the A12 amendments to House Bill 2800. Councilman, would you tell us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The A12 amendments are conflict amendments. They amend the bill in three different sections. They replace Section 12 with 12A, which are procedures for the right to sue and notification and the statute of limitations. It repeals Section 15, which is now covered in Section 12A, and it changes the references in Section 17 in new 17A. These are done to comply with House Bill 2352, which was a civil rights rewrite.
All right. Any further discussion on the adoption of the A12 amendments to House Bill 2800? Not. Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2800 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2800 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered. I believe I was a carrier on that bill. Continue to carry the bill. Now, let's see. House Bill 2100 is going to be set over until tomorrow. House Bill 2646 is not going to be moved. As we previously moved that to Ways and Means, it's going to stay there. 2942 is also set over until tomorrow, and we're now down to public hearings on House Bill 2429 and 3931. 2429 is the civil forfeiture law, and so let's go into public hearing. House Bill 2429. Councilors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2429 rewrites the civil forfeiture laws that was necessitated by the recent passage of Ballot Measure 3, which prescribes procedures governing all civil forfeitures that became effective last December. It Ballot Measure 3 provided that the owner of property sought to be forfeited must be convicted of a crime, and the property must be connected to the crime for which the owner was convicted as either instrumental in committing the crime or facilitating the crime or as proceeds of the crime. The burden of proof has been increased. Currently, a preponderance, it now must, the forfeiting agency must prove its case by clear and convincing evidence. The amount of the forfeiture must be proportionate and not excessive to the conduct for which the person is convicted. The recovery of expenses related to the forfeiture, excluding any law enforcement expense, is limited to 25% of the revenue in any case, and forfeiture revenue cannot be used for a law enforcement purposes. The measure also imposes limitations on transfers of forfeiture proceedings to the federal government and the use of forfeiture revenue received from the federal government. This bill comes to you from a work group that was convened by the Interim Judiciary Committee and the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Committee, and was comprised of a cross-section of representatives, supporters of the Ballot Measure 3, Forfeiture Council, Law Enforcement, Department of Justice, District Attorneys, and Defense Counsel.
All right. Soon we have a sign-up list somewhere.
We're going 29, 40 times. Right?
So, 24, 29.
Thank you.
All righty then. All right, David Bedanke. Jeff Sugarman and Dinah. Wolfman, Vidal.
I'm seeing them in my dreams. I made them stars, didn't I? This year, committee made them stars.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Bedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. On my left is Dinah Vidalins of the Department of Justice, and Jeff Sugarman of Oregonians for Property Protection. As staff counsel has told the committee, this bill was the outgrowth of a work group which included a broad cross-section of individuals, organizations, and government representatives who have followed the civil forfeiture process since Oregon civil forfeiture law was adopted in 1989. I believe council has distributed to you a copy of Ballot Measure 3. If I could, Mr. Chair, before Ms. Vidalins walks through some of the procedures of the bill, and we won't take a lot of time today. Mr. Sugarman, I believe, wanted to present some testimony talking about the provisions of Ballot Measure 3.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Sugarman. I represent Oregonians for Property Protection, the group that drafted and passed Measure 3. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2429 on behalf of the chief petitioners. This bill represents, as Council O'Dell mentioned, the hard work of a very large group of people, including representatives of the Oregon District Attorney's Association, Multnomah County, the City of Portland, Lane County District's Attorney's Office, former State Representative Floyd Prezansky, Mr. Bedanke, and many of the others that you see before you today. Legislative staff members, including Council O'Dell, Dave Hendricks, Phil Lemon, and others contributed dozens of hours of hard work to help us craft fair and effective legislation to implement the measure passed by 67.2% of the voters in every single Oregon county last November. Council O'Dell outlined the key provisions of the measure, so I won't go into detail of those, although they are in my written testimony. Oregonians for Property Protection believes that House Bill 2429 effectively and fairly implements Measure 3. We appreciate all the hard work that has gone into making this a workable vehicle for law enforcement to continue to use with the restrictions placed on it by the voters of this state, and we urge the committee to pass House Bill 2429 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dinah Vidalins, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm also counsel for the Oregon State Police and handle their forfeiture matters. The work group on House Bill 2429 got together early in November after ballot measure 3 passed. I have to tell you that law enforcement was not happy to come to the table, but we needed to in order to implement certain portions of the ballot measure 3 so that we could still proceed with civil forfeiture proceedings. And the key features of 2429 that enable us continue to do that is that it codifies the fact that if there's no claim filed, that a law enforcement agency may still seize and forfeit and obtain a default judgment. In addition, if a complaint is filed and then the defendant leaves without us being able to obtain a conviction, that we can again apply to the court for a default judgment. And finally, the most important provision is that there's an opportunity, the fact that we're required to obtain a conviction before forfeiture, we were required, ballot measure 3 didn't tell us how we could do that because a conviction is normally going to take longer than a civil proceeding, and we were worried that defendants would come in and say, move for a summary judgment or otherwise move to strike our complaint because we could not allege a conviction at the time we filed our complaint. And House Bill 2429 takes care of that. That's all I have.
Sure, huh? David?
Mr. Chair, just a few other things. One of the key components of House Bill 2429 is that it brings all civil forfeitures underneath the oversight of the Asset Forfeiture Oversight Advisory Committee, and it is anticipated that over the next few years, as this new system gets into place, the Oversight Committee will come back to this legislature to recommend any changes. There is also a four-year sunset provision in this bill, which is why it may seem longer and more confusing than it actually needs to be. The bill would sunset July 31st of 2005. That is the identical date for the sunset on the criminal forfeiture bill, which is now on its way to this committee from the House. To reiterate something that Ms. Vidalin said, Measure 3 did not change the standard for seizure of property which is subject to forfeiture. It only changes the standard that is to be applied prior to that forfeiture being finalized. And one of the exceptions to Measure 3, there are several exceptions, one of which Ms. Vidalin has already explained, is the exception for unclaimed property or abandoned property. No conviction is required in those situations. And under existing law, as we've seen over the last 10 years or so, about 80% of all civil forfeiture cases are finalized without any claim ever being filed. So that is the vast majority of forfeiture cases. There also is an exception for contraband, which we'll get to in the next bill, Mr. Chair, that you're going to be hearing today, House Bill 3931. I know during the prior to the beginning of the legislative session, Senator Courtney attended one of the work group meetings by telephone and asked some questions about how ballot measure 3 would affect forfeitures for vehicles in driving under the influence cases. And I just wanted to point out to the committee that the bill makes a very minor change in the existing state forfeiture law related to DUI, and that shows up on page 59 of the bill. Section 18 of the bill, which just clarifies that vehicles can still be seized under that statute, and then final action on the forfeiture takes place pursuant to the procedures in House Bill 2429. So that the car can be seized and held pending the conclusion of the criminal case for which the person is arrested.
Right. Who can give us an update on the legal challenges to Measure 3?
I can give them. Mr. Chair, a multiple amendment challenge was filed against ballot Measure 3 by Lincoln County. There are a number of other legal issues that were raised. Marion County Circuit Judge Pamela Abernathy upheld ballot Measure 3 against that multiple amendment challenge. The additional issues are now before the court. I think everyone expects that case will go up on appeal. And one of the reasons that we all wanted the sunset provision was to give that court case time to play out at the appellate level so that we could make whatever adjustments are necessary when that case is concluded.
Mr. Chairman, I have an additional update on that. It's my understanding that this week the counsel for the Lincoln County Interagency Narcotics Task Force asked for a final judgment from the trial court on two of the issues and has asked for the rest of the claims to be dismissed, and the attorney representing us has agreed to that, and that case should be out of the trial court in a very short period of time.
All right.
Yes, sure. And I should know this, but I guess if a car is seized in the prostitution sting, you keep the car until after the person has been either convicted or acquitted. You keep it, it's impounded at that point. And then when the person is found guilty, then you take ownership. Do I have it right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, yes. I mean, the short answer is yes, that's how it would work. There is no state statute that permits forfeiture in prostitution cases, but local governments are permitted to adopt forfeiture as a consequence of any conduct which is criminal, and some jurisdictions have done so. The city of Portland has for prostitution. There may be other jurisdictions I'm not aware of. Under current law and under House Bill 2429, it is possible for the vehicle to be returned to the owner prior to the conclusion of the criminal case, subject to conditions that can be worked out. In most cases in Portland, those vehicles seized in prostitution cases are released very quickly as a result of negotiated agreements.
Any questions, Chair?
Senator Metzger.
Dave, on 18A, the motor vehicle seizure, I just read the thing. I always sound really two words changed. Can you tell me what the difference is from what was eliminated in the new language? Because it's, I found only two words that were just kind of changed.
Correct.
Explain the difference to me, please.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, Section 18 is the new section. Section 18A is the sunset provision that would reinstate current law in 2005. Under Section 18, the only two changes that are being made is a deletion and on line 19 of the words "and forfeited" and the insertion of ABC's for civil forfeiture. Clarify that we're talking about civil forfeiture here, not criminal forfeiture. And then again, that down in subsection 2 on lines 27 and 28, the insertion of the word civil to clarify that we're talking about seizure and civil forfeiture proceedings must be conducted in accordance with all of the other changes that are being made by House Bill 2429, rather than spelling all that out here.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? None.
Thank you.
You guys did such a wonderful job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You guys also signed up on 3931 or not?
I did.
Good. public hearing on 2429 and open a public hearing on 3931. Let's go. Karen?
Yes.
Quigley?
Quigley.
Okay. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Quigley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services. Thank you for this opportunity to offer a little background on the statutes addressed in HB 3931A and to talk briefly about the efforts that a group of people worked on to craft some sort of solution to what I believe even the proponents of ballot measure 3 feel was an unintended target of the ballot measure, namely the archaeological and cultural resource protection statutes. If I may, Mr. Chair, I'll just describe a little bit about those statutes. There are three chapters in ORS that deal with archaeological objects and the cultural resource policy of the state. If I may, I just would like to make very clear at the beginning that nothing is being changed in HB 3931 in terms of the policy or the current statute regarding these resources, except for the forfeiture provisions because of the requirements of ballot measure 3. Now, the first chapter that I'd like to talk about is ORS 97, which has to do with what I call the critical four categories. And those are Indian human remains, funerary objects, sacred objects, and objects of cultural patrimony. And essentially, if you're dealing with any of these critical four objects, wherever and whenever they're encountered, they are to be dealt with by the appropriate Indian tribe. Willful removal, mutilation, destruction, or injury for any of those critical four objects is a Class C felony. Now, ORS 358 and 390 deal with archaeological sites and archaeological objects other than those critical four. The policy of the state of Oregon is that archaeological sites and archaeological objects are irreplaceable and non-renewable cultural resources and an intrinsic part of the heritage of this state and the people of Oregon. ORS 358 and 390 attempt to achieve the preservation and protection of these objects and sites via a permit process. Failure to have the required permits, not having the required permission from a landowner if private property is involved, and I would like to stress that private property requires the landowner's permission. And again, the concern is about not inadvertent discovery of these kinds of objects, but the looting of them. And it's also, the statutes are concerned with the unlawful display or sale of these. There is, in fact, a black market in the Northwest, as there is in the Southwest, for these types of objects. And the law does deal with some notification that's required to the office that I work in, as well as the appropriate Indian tribe, the state police, and the state historic preservation office. If the notification, particularly to the tribes, it does not happen, it's a Class B misdemeanor. Basically, you can't alter, destroy, or excavate an archaeological site on public land without a permit. And again, as I mentioned earlier, the permit on private lands requires the landowner's permission. If objects are removed under a permit, they're usually curated by the Oregon State Museum of Anthropology. But there's alternate curation possible. Some county historical museums curate objects. Some of the tribes, as you may know, have cultural institutes or museums. And the idea is that they are curated close to the place where they're discovered. Again, for those of you who may not be familiar with these statutes and may know professional or amateur archaeologists or people who like to go out looking for arrowheads, there are many ways in which it's legal to hold artifacts in this state.
And I've touched on the idea of inadvertent discovery, for example, in mining, logging, farming operations. The law is not meant to cover those types of things, except, again, if you run into the critical four. Then, in fact, you would contact me, who would put you in touch with the appropriate Indian tribe to make some decisions about reinterment, or if the tribe chose to remove the remains and have them reburied somewhere off the property, it would be at their expense. Those, an arrowhead on the ground that you can just pick up is not covered. Objects that are exposed by the forces of nature are not covered by this statute. So you're talking, again, the scheme was getting at looters. But if I may just say one more time that those critical four items, human remains, sacred objects, funerary objects, objects of cultural patrimony, those have the highest protection. Now, the current law has forfeiture provisions for protected objects and artifacts, and also from proceeds from the sale of those objects and artifacts and the instrumentalities if there's a criminal conviction. When I assume that there was a word search after the passage of ballot measure 3, forfeiture, the archaeological statutes came up, and I was contacted by committee counsel. The tribes were notified. We met with the Department of Justice, Legislative Council, the Governor's Legal Council, the House I'd laugh when I had to admit I was a lawyer too. And so we had one room full of lawyers and then had an invitation extended to the tribes to come discuss what essentially would occur in the original situation is the tribes would be in a worse position after the passage of this measure than they are currently in terms of the getting the objects back, the proceeds back, if in fact they were sold before they could be recovered and returned to the tribe. The plan was, or the strategy was, to try to separate out the part because there was a provision that the tribe could institute forfeiture proceedings, and then also the state could, the attorney general or a district attorney. So after the passage of ballot measure 3, the idea was to separate out. How do you still permit the tribes to be able to do what they can do now in terms of forfeiture, but require the state and to follow the procedures that are now required after ballot measure 3 and 475A. The plan was to give the tribe notice, give them 30 days to decide whether they were going to institute proceedings, and if not, then the state could choose. I must say at this point, as you can imagine, this is not high priority prosecution for the state, but if they were to do this, originally in the original 3931, there wasn't any provision for the tribe, in fact, to get anything out of the proceeding if the state were to bring it. With the amendment that was crafted after discussion on the House side, with the 25% or whatever it is of costs, if the state were to prosecute, the tribes could potentially get the balance forfeited to them. The major tool to separate out how what would be eligible for forfeiture was this idea of contraband that David Fedenke mentioned earlier. And the idea was looters or those who are holding illegally those critical four objects or those archaeological objects that are illegal because you are required to have a permit to hold them, they would be classified as contraband. And this would be like a bank robber with the banknotes. They're not his anyway or hers anyway, And so giving them back to the bank is shouldn't be a problem. And this was the idea with the contraband category. So House Bill 3931 sets up the Critical Four and illegally held artifacts as contraband. When an object is seized, there is also, as a safety provision, a quick check that's provided that someone can show that, no, in fact, these are legally held artifacts, or these are not one of those Critical Four items. And I believe, I hope that's been helpful.
Good,
and if I can answer any questions.
All right. So basically what the bill does is declares certain items of, I guess, Indian heritage or culture that might be found in archaeological, actually it could be on top of the ground, I suppose, but an archaeological dig or find or whatever. Those items would be considered contraband, correct?
Yeah. If they are those Critical Four items, yes,
if
Mr. Chair.
If they are the Critical Four items. Okay.
Or the objects that would require a permit for anyone else to have them.
All right. And these items found any place in Oregon?
Yes, Mr. Chair. On state, public, or private lands.
State, public, and private lands.
If you were to discover human remains on private property, you would need to notify the appropriate Indian tribe about reinterring those remains. If you were someone who knew of a burial site, an Indian burial site, on someone else's private property and snuck in and dug them up, that would be illegal. I mean, not even getting to the trespass issue, but in terms of those remains, it would be.
All right. So, David, this is not necessarily a forfeiture because it's contraband. Is that
right? Mr. Chair, there is another aspect to the bill, which is those situations, and for the record, David Fedanke, ACLU of Oregon, in those situations where artifacts or other materials have been taken out of the ground or transferred and then sold, this bill permits, as current law does, permits a forfeiture of the proceeds from the sale of those illegally obtained items. And that does take place under the forfeiture statute,
that portion would,
as would any instrumentalities that were used in the course of that conduct. And one of the other provisions about Ballot Measure 3 was that it, as Ms. Quigley said, in initial draft, when the state pursued a forfeiture in that type of situation, where there were proceeds or instrumentalities subject to forfeiture, originally the bill just referred to House Bill 2429's procedures, which provides that the proceeds can't be used after forfeiture for law enforcement purposes, and no more than 25% can be applied to the cost of the case. But there is an escape hatch in Ballot Measure 3 that proceeds can be used for other purposes, as long as they're not law enforcement purposes, as authorized by law. So this is a law. Part of what this bill does is provide by statute that those proceeds can be, while not used for law enforcement purposes, can be returned to the tribe that had rightful ownership interest in those objects that were sold and the proceeds were recovered from.
Right.
Well, as they can currently.
Yeah.
So it's not a change in policy, but this bill was required in order to keep that policy in place following the passage of Measure 3.
The language in Section 2 of the bill, is that current law? Is it, this is new?
Mr. Chair, as I understand, Sections 2 and 3 are new, but pretty much just codify what current practice has been, and as it's required to be changed in order to have these options for the tribe to have first crack at the materials.
All right. So let me go down to subsection 2 of section 2. It says all contraband items seized under the provisions of this section shall be delivered to the district attorney. What does that mean? I mean, I got a dead body. It's been in the ground for 2,000 years, and I've got it in a plastic bag. Am I supposed to dump it at the DA's office, or what do you mean by that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, usually what happens is the city police, county police may be called first, or the state police. The DA is probably notified for the most part. They may... I've gotten calls about skulls on steps.
Well, but see, what I would ordinarily do is I would take the item, put it in an evidence bag, seal it, put it in the property room, which belongs to the Portland Police Bureau. It's not the DA's office. What I'm saying is the bill telling me that I now have to deliver it to the DA's office and not the Portland Police Bureau's property room? Because I'll deliver to the DA's office. I don't care.
I assume, Mr. Chair, that it could be delivered any place the district attorney authorized.
Yeah, I would suggest it probably should say so. Senator Beyer?
Chair, I guess my first question would be, you keep referring that this is current policy and current law, and you're just trying to reauthorize that. My understanding that when the voters of Oregon change the Constitution, that changes policy and law. So to say that we're just trying to reauthorize that, I think that's a fallacy. Obviously, the voters of Oregon changed policy and law. So I don't want to just say that we have to do this to stay current. We can't stay current. The voters change current. So that's my first statement, I guess. My questions on this is kind of how this works. I'm a farmer. I'm out working in the field. I find a bone. I'm supposed to call the DA's office. I'm supposed to, according to this, it sounds like I'm supposed to call you.
Mm-hmm.
How would I know that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, most people call the police, and then the police and our training is far from perfect, but it's something that we're working on. Contact this office as the state office that deals with Indian issues, and if the police are called first to ascertain, in fact, whether a crime has been committed, whether it's a homicide site, and the coroner is called in to make the determination about the age of the bone, and if there would be something else that would suggest that it was Indian remains, because that's what this statute is applying to, Indian remains, not other bones.
Okay, another question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Thank you. The chairman said that he finds a body, puts it in a bag. Reality is you rarely, as a landowner, find a body. You find a piece. You find a part, a chip. How am I supposed to know?
That's your experience, Senator Byron?
I'll tell you a story later.
You got parts of Clackamas County, don't you?
But so how am I supposed to see a bone and know? When, I mean, all of a sudden, I've got contraband, and I have no idea if it's an animal bone or an Indian bone or some other kind of bone. I mean, this is really broad. I mean, you don't find, sorry, Mr. Chair, but when you're dealing with 2,000-year-old bodies, you don't find bodies.
I assume you'd find a bone, but I said body just to be expeditious about it. I was thinking skeletal remains or something.
You find pieces.
So,
in terms
of... I don't think people know this. I don't think law enforcement knows.
So law enforcement definitely doesn't know, as far as I know, to call the, you know, your office. I mean, unless it's in one of the handy-dandy little directory books they pass around.
Then one other thing, so it has to be turned over to the appropriate tribe.
How do we know? Their determination, though.
That's your determination. I mean, how do I know as a landowner who the appropriate tribe is?
I think they're supposed to determine that. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, by statute, the Commission on Indian Services determines the appropriate Indian tribe.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Sure.
Again, to Senator Barr's question, the requirement for a landowner to contact the authorities is in ORS Chapter 97, has been for many years. This bill doesn't affect that. All this bill affects is what happens after these types of materials are found and turned over, if the government wants, or an Indian tribe wants, to keep those items, and modifies the procedures for that proceeding to comply with the voter-approved ballot measure 3.
Well, I guess my point is, I'm walking out to the woods, I find a bone. I don't know if it's a dog bone, a deer bone, a human bone, an Indian bone. I might find a chunk of a bone. If I put it in my back pocket and take it home, according to this statute, and it turns out to be some point in time later, an Indian bone, it's contraband, it's a Class C felony.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we're talking about willful. There would have to be the intent, and I think you're saying that you didn't know what type of bone it was. Would not be a situation where you would be prosecuted for having that bone.
Senator Harper, do you have a question? I want to make sure that... Are you done? I want to get back to Senator.
This is an exemption to Measure 3. Is that, am I reading this correctly?
I don't think it's an exemption. I think they're trying to, I guess, honor some of the work that they've done in terms of recognition of the interest of the Indian tribes in terms of ownership of archaeological artifacts related to their particular tribe. That's my guess.
This statute currently contains a civil forfeiture proceeding, but because it did not require that there was a conviction and the other protections that were necessitated by ballot measure 3, and because the Indian tribes as sovereign nations are not subject to the requirements of ballot measure 3, it was necessary to split out the civil forfeiture into two essentially different avenues. One where the tribe has the first notice if they want to pursue a civil forfeiture, that they can pursue it. And they're not required to have a conviction like ballot measure 3 requires. We picked up exactly what the existing requirements are and continued those for Indian tribes. If the Indian tribe doesn't pursue it, then the state has an option to pursue it. And I don't think that I know that in the last year, not one person was actually even criminally prosecuted under any of these statutes, but that's sort of a separate issue. But if the state pursues a forfeiture proceeding, then it proceeds with reference to ORS Chapter 475A, which is amended in the House Bill 2429, which we had just heard about. So what it does is it really just splits those out into two different proceedings. It doesn't impose any different obligations on anyone who would find something. That's already provided under completely other law. This is just the procedure for forfeiting those kinds of things. And we did, in drafting this, because there are certain classes which Karen has called the sacred for or the something for, we treated those as contraband because that allows a sort of summary procedure for returning those items to the appropriate person, but did put in some due process protections because in rare cases there are individuals that have permits or licenses or to own some of those objects. Some can't be owned at all, but there are others that do.
So this is not an exemption or exception to Measure 3?
No, it's not an exemption to Measure 3.
Why do we need the bill, and what are we trying to fix here?
We're trying to allow civil forfeiture to continue in this area.
Why do we need to allow that to continue? Who stopped it?
What's the question again?
What stopped civil forfeiture in this area?
Well, because the procedure that's currently in statute is not constitutionally sufficient,
we were trying to, in proposing, putting this bill together, to make it constitutional rather than leave the current statute as is, which would have been unconstitutional because it didn't comply with the requirements of ballot measure 3.
But you've really got a bifurcated process here, don't you? I mean, I think Senator Harper's question is kind of a good one. Why do you need civil forfeiture if you declare them to be contraband and they're not owned by the person who finds them? Then, you know, it's a different process. In essence, it's not forfeiture per se. You know, I guess the only place you get into is the other
proceeds and instrumentalities.
Proceeds and instrumentalities. And I don't know too much about this, but I do know that there are some folks out there who have pillaged some archaeological digs and other things and have taken items out. And there's you and I probably don't engage in this kind of thing, but they're actually they have these things in ownership or trade or sell, kind of on a secondary market in different places.
And Mr. Chair, in such a situation where you had an ongoing kind of criminal enterprise that was engaged in the marketing and sale of these kinds of protected artifacts and remains, Measure 3 requires not only that there be a concurrent prosecution, but a conviction prior to the final forfeiture for things other than what is declared contraband by this bill.
All right. Does that make sense? No? Yes? Maybe? Any other questions? Senator?
Thank you.
No, I'm fine. Mr. Chair, I was thinking. You want to put the bill down?
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to know how this pertains, and Senator Harper would know, I hope, to know a lot more about this than I do, but there is a person in his district who he's either in jail or he's lost all his land because he built a reservoir with all the permission of the state and federal government. After the reservoir was built, at the dedication ceremonies, they found some artifacts in the site. Do you know what I'm speaking of?
He was given a permit from the Bureau, from BLM. And they found after he'd done the project, they found, you know, Indian remains, and then he lost everything.
After
a permit from the federal government.
Yeah, he had all the proper permits from the state and federal government, and after this was all done, and the project's concluded at the dedication ceremony, I think is what it was it somebody walking across the dike happened to notice a chip on the person lost everything. Because it turned out it was an Indian, bone. If that's the kind of thing that this is going to create.
I don't think this creates that. I think that problem...
That's there now.
That would already exist. I mean, I think whatever duties or obligations you have on your private property, and if you own 1,000 acres in southern Oregon, you know, where the northern Paiute Indians used to, you know, hunt and fish and camp and so on and so forth, it turns out that where your house is built happens to be, you know, where they were also building houses and, you know, had Indian artifacts there. I don't know what happens to your house. You know,
I take it.
Yeah, I mean, in one sense, I just don't know what the process is. But I don't know. I just don't know. But I don't think this bill affects any of that at this point.
But I guess my point is, does Measure 3 would have affected that? And now this bill is taking us right back to where we were prior to Measure 3.
I think Council said no.
I don't think ballot Measure 3 has affected that.
Okay. We're going to have some time to stew on this. Think about it. We're going to wait until we get to some of the other forfeiture stuff over here before we do anything. With that, we are adjourned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.